Hey folks, welcome to this week's podcast. Very excited to give you part two of my interview with Stone Cold Steve Austin, the wrestler. Really cool conversation, went in a lot of different directions that I didn't expect, and this week we talk about more about his career as a wrestler, how he got started, how he grew his persona, and sort of, you know, the hurdles that he had to cross to become as big as he was, and his acting career now. Just a really cool conversation that goes in a lot of different directions, and it's one of the reasons I really, really love this interview. If you didn't check out part one, please do. A lot of cool stuff in that conversation as well. Also, send the podcast around. Send links. Tell your friends about it. Review it on iTunes. We'd love to get some reviews up too. And November 25th and 26th, I'm going to be headlining at Gotham Comedy Club in New York City. That's Thanksgiving weekend, Friday and Saturday, November 25th and 26th. So come on out if you're in the New York area, New Jersey area, Connecticut, and check me out. And thanks for checking out the podcast, everybody.
Let me ask you this. So the storyline of the feud between you and McMahon, was that something that you came up with initially, they came up with? Was that, and then how did that, was it always set that way? Did it evolve over time? And how fun was it to be feuding with your boss in front of everybody? That must have been fun to slap your boss around.
Well, let me just talk about working with Vince, because Vince is a third generation promoter, and Vince's father was never going to let him in the wrestling business just because he wanted him to do something else. Mm-hmm. He was having a hard time promoting a town called Bangor, Maine.
Mm-hmm. I know that, yeah.
Vince's dad said, if you go over there and promote Bangor and make it a success, I'll let you in the business. Vince went over and worked his ass off. The show was a success. He got in the business. Vince's dad would never let him be an in-ring performer. Finally, you know, Vince's father passed away sometime later after mm-hmm. Vince bought the territory from him, and it was Vince's show. Then I come along, and man, me and Vince just have just total chemistry with each other. And the one thing that I've always loved about being in the ring or being on the other side of a microphone with Vince McMahon is my passion, my belief, all of my everything that I feel in my heart and my guts about the business, he feels the exact same way. And it's these two. It's these two dynamic forces going head to head.
And what are those similarities that you both have?
Just flat out, man. When I think of wrestling, I think adrenaline. I think testosterone rush, physicality, just stories. You know, the crowd, the energy that you get when once you make your entrance, that adrenaline spike is like nothing else in this world. And when you're trying to draw money, you've got to have someone who is totally loved against someone who is totally hated. Yeah. You don't want a whole lot of this gray stuff. It's black versus white. Yeah. It's black and white world. And so that's what I got out of Vince. And, you know, I think basically the whole storyline started as his idea and just based on the way that I was coming up because, you know, I was a heel. But, you know, because I was becoming so entertaining –
where did that term come from, heel?
Oh, this is just way back in the old days.
Why baby face for the good guy?
Well, you know, like a baby face, good-looking guy. Cute, you know, he doesn't always have to be good-looking, but by and large, most of the time, they kind of are.
The good guy, the good guys are really
and a heel is that, you know, the heel.
And you were always a heel coming up, weren't you?
I started off as a baby face in Dallas. Right. But it's funny for me in the movie business, they say, oh, okay, they got a part for you in this movie. They want you to be the heavy. The heavy is their version of a heel. Heavy. That sounds like a guy that weighs 400 pounds. Let me be the heel. So, I think it was, because I was a heel when I first came in as a ringmaster, and Stone Cold really turned it up, and I was really starting to get on fire. But because I was so entertaining and because the timing was what it was, people started cheering me. And many times I would be getting more cheers as a heel than the babyface I was working with. Hey. So Vince smelled that and said, okay, all we're going to do is just kind of not turn you babyface, but transition you into a babyface by your opposition in the ring. So I started working more with heels rather than babyfaces, and that kind of, but the key moment was a match in Chicago, Illinois, WrestleMania 13, between myself and Bret the Hitman Hart, one of the greatest pro wrestlers who ever lived. Yeah. And at the time, you know, Bret had such a long run and a successful run, but he'd kind of started pissing and moaning a little bit. People were starting to turn on him. Vince smelled that, put us in the ring together. We did a double turn, a very, very difficult execution. of, you know, going as a heel, leaving as on being on my way to a babyface. We still had work to do, and leaving with Brett on his way to being a heel, a 180 by both guys. And so then it only made sense for Vince to pit himself and myself together, and then coupled with the fact, like you said, anybody that's ever had a job at one time or another would have loved to just punch the hell out of their damn boss.
Right. So that totally, you totally.
Yeah, that's money.
It's very creative, and people. I think people, maybe rabid pro wrestling fans get how creative it is, but I think a lot of people don't. Like the creativity that goes into these storylines. Do you like the storyline era, or do you like the WWE Attitude era better? What do you think is a?
Well, it's all storyline driven. But I just think, you know, the...
But there was a more Attitude Era at one time.
Oh, yeah, did yeah. You, the Attitude Era was defined as about a 10-year period.
Right.
And, you know, but my take on that was, you know how I'm a big metal fan, mm-hmm. hard rock fan, because mm-hmm. I love country music as well, but it's almost insulting for some of the bands to be considered in the hair band. Or some of the acts that had hair aren't in a hair band, but it was during that era.
Right.
So, but they're labeled as a hair band.
Right.
Hey, man, my take on the business is pro wrestlers have always had attitude. It's kind of when I showed up and I instigated that whole real in your face thing that, and, you know, certainly I had a lot of help with, you know, the DX, New Age Outlaws, and Triple H, and The Rock coming into his own, doing his thing. So then it all kind of turned in like everybody was, hey, this pissed off animal at the system. But I've always thought that wrestlers all have attitudes. But in today's day and age...
But you feel like you need to have more than just attitude to really sell a great product to the public. You need to have those...
I don't think you have enough attitude right now. I just think that... And I'm not being critical of the business. You know, WWE is in my blood. It will be for life. I've busted my ass to help make that company. And... But when you start talking creative, I mean, that's when I'm very picky and very critical.
And why do you think it's lacking attitude? Because it's funny, because in comedy, I think a lot of people feel that, too. Like, there's not a lot of... There's a lot of good comedians, but we were talking off air before we started. It is about defining who you are and what your attitude is, and there's that seems to be missing a little bit in comedy. I think, why is that not happening?
Then it is this the same thing that happens in your world? Sometimes I think that in trying to be corporate and trying to encompass a larger payoff, you become too PC and lose a little bit of your identity.
You become very general, like want to appeal to like McDonald's, you want to appeal to everybody, and you become soft around the edges,
mean, to me, as Stone Cold, I was all about pushing that creative envelope.
Right.
And every now and then, here and there, we pull back a little bit. But, you know, when I started saying some of the words I said, you know, I remember Vince came coming up to me one time and asked, I started flipping people off as well, and he said, hey, man, everybody else is... All the people are starting to, you know, use the middle finger. Is there another sign you can use that everybody can do? And I said, no. I said, there's not. And he was okay with it. But I gave him an honest answer.
Right.
And also, we were ringing up the cash register. And, man, it's in anything. As you know, it's hard to find that one person, that one act who's just going to bring people in by the droves. And when you have one, it's special.
Yeah.
And there's only been, you know, a few, and there's been many, many great characters, many, many great workers, promo guys, the whole gamut from top to bottom. And right. It takes all those people to make a card and continue the business. But those cats who came along every now and then and drew stupid money, I was one of those guys. Yeah. So... You know, you don't want to jack with a guy like that too much.
No, but you think they're afraid? The wrestlers today are afraid to have that attitude to go that far because they want to be liked by. They're trying to figure out how to be liked by as many people as possible to get that big payday.
Man, I think the system. I think guys, new guys coming up these days. You know, back in the old days, we're sitting at a desk. We're sitting at a desk. It's probably 2 feet wide and 4 feet long. So say this desk was the United States of America, you know, 20 years ago, and all over this desk where this lamp is and that Red Bull can and my phone and your phone, these are all different territories where guys would learn to work and they were promos and promotions in and of themselves. And that's where they stayed to make their money. And when they ran their course there, they'd go to another territory and start up there. Well, there's none of that anymore. This big table is the WWE. Everybody's at the table. You don't have any other place to go. It's a lot more politics now involved than it used to be.
Right.
If I got tired of playing over here on the West Coast, I could pack up my bags, haul ass over here to Florida, and really kick some ass. I got tired of Florida, I might go to the Carolinas and take my bag of tricks.
Yeah.
These days, they got all the rules laid down, and this is how it's going to be. And with all these little territories that's going on along, also the education process of guys paying their dues, starving, learning how to work, and sometimes this guy down here in Alabama territory, he'd been working 10 years, and all of a sudden he gets that call to go up to the big show. He's a working some bitch.
Yeah.
You know, he's got his chops down. He's got his act down. So I just think the system these days is just controlled by the WWE from the office down.
Yeah.
There's, I think, a lot of guys, let me bottom line it. There's a lot of guys walking on eggshells right now. Sometimes you got to walk on eggshells for a little bit, but then you got to put your damn fist through the wall, break through, and just go for it.
It's just maybe not, the, like you're saying, the way it was before with these sort of, you could kind of go to these smaller territories and grow and define your persona and all of that, where it's hard to do that on a national stage when there's so much at stake.
And it's, and you know, again, you know, that's just me talking about the system currently.
Yeah.
Man, when I talk about the business, I'm very passionate about the business. It's a business
that I've
watched my entire life and I love. But sometimes I feel for these cats who are in the system now, because it's almost like they show up, the office says, okay, you're going to be this person. Like I said, I was going to be the ringmaster. Hey, at least I had the guts and the intelligence to say, this ain't working. Let's try this. Because I played by their game for 6 months. I gave it a try. But that's one thing that I've always liked about Vince. One of the smartest guys I've ever met in my life. And if you have a good idea, he'll listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my point is, if anybody listens to this that's in a wrestling business and you work for WWE and things ain't going the right way, mm-hmm. have that heart-to-heart with Vince and maybe open his eyes a little bit. He's a businessman that will always listen to a good idea.
Does wrestling forget its people in some ways the way pro football has, especially with these head trauma issues and all of that? I mean, look, you've got a great career. You're in your second act. That doesn't mean anybody, right? You did your first act. Now you're doing your second act, and you're doing two movies this summer. Just let's remind people, you've got the third season of Redneck Island happening this month, premiering. You're in Grown Ups 2. You've got a great podcast on Podcast One with a lot of followers and listeners. But for every one of you, right, there's a bunch of guys that we never barely heard of or saw of who are whatever. And not that wrestling owes them anything, but like, to the extent you can and talk about it, like, is there an issue there? Like,
well, man, it's a funny business. You know, back in the day, you know, obviously, it's like wrestling these days, or when I was around, is different than, is just the same as NFL today versus NFL of yesteryear, when those guys didn't make any money.
Yeah.
I mean, they made money, but, you know, ain't a lot you can just put in the bank and be set for life. So there's been many guys who come down, you know, the road in professional wrestling and paved the way for guys like myself, you know, paid the dues. And by the time they got out, you know, they're pretty much, you know, beat to shreds and didn't know what else to do.
Yeah.
I always tell people, I'm not a dummy, but I'm not the smartest guy in the world. Mm-hmm. Being outstanding in a 20x20 ring doesn't make me a rocket scientist at any other thing in life. Now, I am an entertainer. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say, okay, man, now I'm going to tell you how E equals MC squared.
But you're no dummy. Look, one of the things that I think everybody is going to take away from this, and the same thing with what performers do in show business, actors, musicians, comedians, it is a lot more complicated than it looks. It ain't, you just set out in a very short amount of time, a guy that went from coming out of college, figuring out what he was going to do, to having the brains to figure out, okay, I need to have a persona, studying, watching. No, this isn't the persona. No, this is the persona. Like, you're a pretty savvy guy. I mean, because you can't get this far in a profession and not be, it just be like a walking muscle machine that punches people in the face in a ring. You're more than that.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm okay. I'm certainly not a rocket scientist. I can't save the world, and I can't cure a lot of major diseases.
Really? Because I got a disease, and I was going to ask you to cure it.
Well, right. We're going to save that for when you're on the Steve Austin show.
All right, okay.
But it was like we were sitting here an hour ago having a conversation before we started rolling this recorder.
Yeah.
And sometimes, because I was asking you about being a stand-up comedian,
right.
And you come from a legal background,
right.
You were a lawyer,
right.
And then all of a sudden you delved into comedy. You weren't afraid to change your direction.
Right.
So in the business of professional wrestling or in any walk of life, because I always love to, I've been lucky enough for people to live vicariously through the Stone Cold thing or gain strength through that character and get them through a lot of hard times. And as much BS as I have on my show, I always try to, keep that message going that you can be anything and everything that you want to be in life. Don't be afraid to take that dirt road we were talking about earlier. Don't be afraid to go out on a limb look at yourself in the mirror and believe, in that cat that's looking back at you.
Right.
So, those are some of the things that I followed. And, when I, had enough injuries that I needed to get out of the business of professional wrestling, acting wasn't my first passion or what I wanted to do with
really because in life. I was curious about did you start to plan your second act when you're 7, 8 years, 10 years, whatever in the wrestling, going, this ain't gonna last forever, this is my path.
No, it was gonna last forever. And then all of a sudden it didn't. I had those cards in my hand and someone said, no, give me those cards back. These are the cards you're playing with now. So, I said,
was it the injuries? Is that
it was the injuries. And what I did was I stayed in Texas for about 3 years, drank a bunch, did a bunch of stupid stuff.
Did you have your broken neck ranch then?
Yeah, no, not then. I hadn't bought it yet. But just did a lot of nothing. And finally I woke up and said, dude, you're 40 years old. You better get your ass back to work. You're much too young to not do anything. And you've got to be productive in life. Yeah. Life is all about hard work. The harder you work and the smarter you work, the further down the road you can go.
Yeah.
And so that's when I came out to Los Angeles and lived with Dallas Page for about a year and a half.
Yeah.
And when I first came out here, I just came out here and drank and did the same things that I was doing in Texas, just did them in L.A. minus the hunting.
I met him, by the way, when I did that piece
Dallas is going to be on my show coming up. He's doing really good with his yoga program, and he's helping out a lot of guys. Oh, and I want to get back to answering your question the guys. He's helping out a lot of guys at his house in Atlanta with Jake Snake Roberts and Scott Hall, who had some major problems back in the day. And he's helping those guys out. He's been instrumental in turning a lot of people's lives around. So Dallas is doing wonderful.
That's great.
You got to go down the road, find something else to do. And when my wrestling cards ran up, I said, okay, I got to get a new set of cards. And I never said it at the house when I was 10 years old, thinking, man, I would love to be an actor. I'd love to be on that big screen. I'd love to be a star in a movie. I didn't have none of that. I want to be a pro wrestler. So with that being said, because, I knew what I knew inside that squared circle, I didn't want to go back to driving that forklift. With all due respect, because, had I not gotten in the business of pro wrestling, I was built to move heavy objects, and I love to do it.
People say that about me too.
Yeah, but for me, for some reason, moving heavy objects is very satisfying to me. And I was working on a freight dock, loading and unloading trucks.
Right.
Like to this day, if we're at my house and I'll move a big ass piece of furniture, and my wife will say, "Well, how are you going to do that? You don't have anybody to help you."
Yeah.
Oh, don't worry, I'll get it done.
Yeah.
She goes to do whatever she's going to do. When she comes back, the thing is moved. She says, "Well, how did you do that?" I said, that's what I do. So I didn't want to go back to doing that as a pro.
Yeah.
So that's when I came out here to L.A. and started acting. And to go down the road I'm going down now, and I love reality television. I love my podcast. I'm having so much fun sitting here talking to you because you're just a little bit further along at this than I am.
No.
But going back to the business about the guys, the road, in that line of work, I've seen so many guys blow all their money up their nose. I've seen so many guys that didn't pay their taxes. I've seen so many guys squander a lot of opportunity, and that's hard to see, and you feel for guys like that. And that's why when I talk to these young cats, I stress education to anybody that's trying to get into business. I stress saving money to anybody who's in the business. It's like that old promoter used to tell us back in the day when we weren't making shit.
Yeah.
You know, you're driving 400 miles round trip and your payoff is $15. And you finally get that paycheck, and it's a double-digit paycheck. It's not even three digits. You didn't even make $100 for the week. And they tell you, ah, don't worry, kid. It ain't what you make. It's what you save. You can't save anybody if you ain't making no money. So I don't know that I don't think there'll ever be a union.
Yeah.
I don't think there'll ever be any kind of class action lawsuits coming out of the pro wrestling business.
Why not a union? Guys. I think comedians should have a union. We tried it, but everybody was... too much an individual.
There you go. You just said it.
Too many renegades.
Everybody's too much of an individual, and the guys that are making it, and they're not going to screw the pooch. And, you know, on one hand, they'd like to help a brother out.
But you're no different than football, basketball, baseball. You're amazing physical specimens who are putting on a show for money that's a sport. Why not gather together? And I mean, you know, the power that you would have if you all looked at a Vince McMahon and said, you want one of us, you need all of us, and you got to take us as a group. You know what I mean?
Well, listen, that window that you speak of right now could have happened back in the day when I was in the ring. But man, I was going and blowing and doing my thing. Yeah. And
you didn't want to screw the pooch.
Quite honestly, the money was
too good.
I wasn't thinking about anybody else. Now, the guys who were on my card, man, I had referees come thank me because they were buying houses, you know. So I'm not sitting there blowing smoke up my ass because I don't do that. But, I mean, that's the kind of money that was going around back then, and you had to have saved it. And now that my window is done, you know, when you're done pulling that wagon, you're done pulling that wagon.
Yeah.
If somebody wanted to do a union now, it would have to be the top couple of guys in that organization rounding everybody up and saying, hey, guys, let's do this. Because the lowest person on that ladder in the WWE right now is not going to rally everybody up and then go to those top two or three guys and say, hey, listen, here's what we're thinking. Because they ain't going to listen.
Right, exactly.
See what I'm saying?
So what is a Vince McMahon, what is a power broker looking for in a wrestler? In another way of saying it, and you just touched on it, but I'd like you to elaborate. For the guys coming up, the guy that's just who thought he was going to play football professionally, was in your shoes and said, okay, that's not my goal, but I want to wrestle. What would you advise them to do? Not just, I know, obviously behave, keep your nose clean and whatever, but like in terms of developing themselves and finding a persona for themselves, what is it that they should do?
You need to sit down and watch it. 8 to 12 hours of wrestling for every single day that you get up. Okay, now, obviously everybody doesn't have those 8 to 12 hours because you're going to spend maybe 3 to 5 learning how to work, learning how to wrestle.
Yeah.
So a minimum of 3 to 4 hours a day of watching tapes. And you don't want, watch what's going on in the current situation, but in a current landscape of what's going on in the business right now. But if you really want to learn, you watch stuff from the mid-80s till about the late 90s, stuff out of the Carolinas with NWA before they went to WCW, and stuff out of Mid-South and Power Pro, a little bit of stuff out of AWA, even a little bit of stuff out of WWF or WWF before they kind of changed into the regime that they are now. Prior to myself, go back to watching those mid-80s tapes because that was when the work was the work. You know, like when I was in Tennessee.
You mean physical, technical work?
Oh, just the in-ring stories.
Yeah.
Like when I was in Tennessee.
Wait, be clear. The storylines or the physical?
The work. The work in the ring. Check it out.
The moves.
I'm going to explain it to you right now.
Okay.
We got a ring sitting right here by this microphone. Okay, now let's take the USWA territory, which was my second stop. After I was hired in Dallas, I worked for 2 months, and that's when Jerry Jarrett sent me to Tennessee, and that was a weekly territory. Here's the schedule. Monday was Memphis. Most everybody's based out of Nashville. Monday is Memphis. Tuesday is Louisville, Kentucky. Wednesday is Evansville, Indiana. Thursday was a local spot show within 100 miles of Nashville. After the spot show, everybody parked the car. Waylon Jennings' tour bus was waiting, which Jerry Jarrett leased. Everybody jumped on the tour bus, drove all night. right outside the outskirts of Nashville to get to Dallas, Texas. Get to Dallas, Texas midday, hang out, go get a workout, work the Sportatorium in Dallas, Texas Friday night, go to the liquor store, which is right across the street, get back on the bus, drive all night, make Memphis by morning, go on live TV at 10 a.m., put on an hour and a half wrestling show, get back in the bus, go to the spot where you left your car on Thursday, grab your car, go back to your hotel in Nashville, take a shower, maybe get a nap, then go to Nashville Fairgrounds and work Nashville that night. Sunday, you either worked or you had a day off. You did that every single week, the same towns over and over again. You didn't have a chance to settle into a routine or a shtick or kind of stick to that same basic match. These days in WWF, even so when I was there, you know, if you're taking a big loop around the United States, you might be able to work with that same cat about a month or two and just kind of keep same. Well, back then you couldn't, you know, anywhere.
And that's a good, because it's teaching you. You're learning.
You can never do the same thing.
So it's forcing you to be creative with your technique,
yes,
with your storylines.
You're always thinking each night, and you know, and sometimes you know you're working with that. You're working a program with that same guy. So, you know, got to keep changing things up.
Okay, meaning your opponent's the same opponent night in and night out.
So you'll start to have
a certain move. He'll have a certain move, counter move, blah, 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 boom, and you get into a routine.
Kind of
and you're not growing as a wrestler. It's exactly the same thing for comedians. Like, you have to keep challenging yourself, writing new material, coming up with new ideas, coming up with new bits.
But many times you would love to stay with those bits. You would like to stay with that routine because you're afforded the luxury of doing that if you're not pressed to change.
Yes.
So you and me are working a program, and we're in Tennessee, and we start off Monday, and you know we lock up, and I'm going to work your neck this whole match. Okay, well, the next night, that's in Memphis Tuesday in Louisville, there's going to be a lot of the same people that they're going to follow that show around. Hey, we can't, you know, next time we go to work, I'm probably going to be working your arm. Wednesday in Evansville, because we're still going to be working. We're working a program on top. We're the main storyline. I'm working your damn leg in Evansville. Thursday night, that spot show, I might go back to the Monday match we work just to do a little bit of that.
And are you telling, having these conversations ahead of time, saying I'm going to work your leg?
Oh, no, man.
So now, where does this thing of like working a certain body part, where's that folk? Is that just something that's always been done in wrestling that, you know, you decide, okay, this is the match I'm going to work the arm. Like,
trying to work that guy into a position of weakness that you can bend his, shoulders to the mat for a three count. And you know, you don't just start up. Okay, let's look at you and me going to the ring right now. Okay, just start beating the hell out of each other.
I would kick your ass.
I know, dude. That's never going to happen. This is a hypothetical.
It better be a hypothetical.
We got to tell a story. You know, you can take the A to B route, or are you going to take that long and winding route? Because those people paid to see, you know, a storyline. If I'm the bad guy in this match and everybody loves the hell out of you because you're that handsome white meat baby face, and they want to see you whip my ass because I've already pissed them off, we've got to tell a story in the process.
Right.
I mean, if you just go out there and beat me like that and the fans go home, on one hand, they got to see you win. But on the other hand, we're trying to draw money on a week-to-week basis.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're going to give them a 15, 20-minute ride, and then I'm going to cheat to win.
Yeah.
And God dang, they're going to be madder than a hornet, and they're going to see you whip my ass next week, so they're going to pay again to see, you know, the rematch.
Right.
So it's just all a psychology type
but,
thing.
But the message to the guys coming up is work as much as you can. Study film. Study technique. Study storylines. Think about your persona. But very importantly, is work as many different venues in different ways that you can, so you're not getting locked into the sort of the same routine, so that you're growing creatively.
That and just as equal to the work, if maybe not even a tad bit more important than the work, is a promo. Man, when Dusty Rhodes would start talking trash or cut a promo, I mean, we always used to call it, he'd talk them into the building. Just talking into the building. His description of a match or what he was going through or what he wanted to do was so vivid and so real, and
that's
you believe
just you
him.
Standing by the ring with a microphone just
right.
preaching,
so
right?
You got to learn how to cut a promo, man, and that was my biggest thing, you know, coming up. All those times, no one really put a microphone in my face, and I was stunning Steve Austin. I never really had a defined character. It was a name that Dutch Mantel gave me. But, you know, if I'm going to base any foundation or base off this character, who and what the hell is Stunning Steve Austin?
Right.
I just kind of thought I was a cocky, arrogant guy. And, you know, my outfit, my ring attire was the shits because I didn't have no money. But other than that, there was not a whole lot of depth to the Stunning Steve character. As I asked Ricky Steamboat that one time, you know, he was just looking at the surface.
Right.
And, hey, it was an okay package. When I came up with the Stone Cold thing, and you knew I was mad, you knew I was anti-system, you knew I was anti-authority, and, you know, that's and that whole look, when I changed into the all black, that was, you know, what worked for me. So learn to cut an effective promo, learn to communicate with people.
Right, that's key. And the starting
you got to reach them.
And the starting point is know your character, your persona, and play to that in the promo.
Right.
And again, I would imagine you learn to do those promos by watching a ton of promos, watching how other guys have done it in the past.
And getting a microphone stuck in your face and having to shit or get off the pot.
Well, it's exactly what we were talking about with stand-up, because we were talking again before the mic started rolling. We were talking about, Steve was asking me, you know, how do you write your stuff or whatever? And I go, you know, some of it you write it on paper for and you go up and do it. And sometimes you just have an idea and you box yourself into a corner on stage and go, I'm just going to start talking about this premise and hopefully a punchline will come out of me. And sometimes it doesn't. More often than not, it doesn't. But then sometimes you get that moment and it's magic because you're all going all on instinct and your head is not getting in the way.
But once you've got that, and maybe it didn't get the result you wanted on the first go around, but when you rethink it, you think, that light goes off and you could have done it.
Right.
So, you know, you got to be able to communicate with people. You got to be able to, you got to be able to people to tap into your emotions and tap into other people's emotions. You got to give them a reason to believe in you, or just if you're trying to work heel, a reason to hate you. Can't just be because you're cocky
or because they're, you're stunning. It's got to be something deeper than that.
Got to be something tangible, real.
Was there ever a moment, and this goes to a larger question of why wrestle? And in answering that, I'm fascinated to know, like a Mick Foley standing up there and looking at a 25-foot drop onto a desk going, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? My back is killing me. My knees, I can't walk. I can't sleep at night when I'm... Like, did you ever have those moments in your career where you're like, what? Why?
No, man, I never did.
Come on, really?
Oh, man. Wow. Yeah, man. I mean, even every now and then, you know, when things are great. But things were very average and piss poor before they got great.
For everybody.
And so it was just the love of being out there, and there's something about...
Is that the why? Is that why you do it?
Dude.
It's that...
Well, there is that. When you walk out there, because that doesn't happen overnight. You know, when I first started walking to the ring in Dallas, Texas, or then in Tennessee, as an unknown, and there I go to the ring, and it's like you can hear excuse my language.
It's okay.
You can hear, you know, a popcorn fart, you know, on row 100. Nobody cares, you got this, you got to go, you know, 8 to 10 minutes with this cat, and nobody cares.
It's like
when
you first come on stage as a comedian, and you know, you're like, it's like,
you know the deal.
Thanks, Mom. Like, that's about it. Yeah.
You're thinking to yourself, really? That's when you think, why am I doing this? But once you get in that ring, and because I grew up as a fan of the business, I remember I was changing the channels in Edna, Texas. Anyway, I was 7 or 8, and I came across Houston Wrestling, and it was a smoke-filled arena. It was the Sam Houston Coliseum. I remember it was like it was yesterday. Two guys in the ring. You could only see about the second or third row. And this was back when wrestling was real, back before all the exposés. And it was two guys fighting for a championship golden belt.
The Bruno Sammartino days?
No. This Bruno was in the Northeast.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, this is the greatest thing ever. You know, so that's why I fell in love with it. That's why I continue to love it. I think it's a little bit of a candy-coated product these days. But, man, when you get in that ring and you get on that mat and you just smell whatever a mat is made of, whether it's burlap or just woven cotton. It's just like a pair of jeans you're wearing, but in that fashion.
Yeah.
And you just have a very thin pad underneath that, and then you have 2x12s on a steel frame. But that mat is the dirtiest thing in the world, because guys are walking around in the dressing room. They just got finished walking down an aisle where people were throwing cups of beer, piss, Coke, popcorn. You got stuff stuck on your feet. You know, the guys who got a little bit of wherewithal will wipe their feet before they get in there. But then someone got busted open. There's blood stains everywhere. It's just something that... when you get down there and you feel those lights beating down on you, and sometimes it's hotter than hell, sometimes the lights are pretty good, that feeling, that smell, you're in heaven.
Really?
If you ever grew up, you know, being a person who wanted to get in the business, that's what it's all about. When you get to throw in all the fun shit, the crowd adulation, the people paying money to see you, the merchandise flying off the damn racks, the adrenaline rush once you get to being that popular guy, that's why you're there.
Yes.
And the travel goes with it. Sometimes the travel was a bear, but man, I lived out of a suitcase when I was hot and heavy. I would go home and I would never unpack my suitcase. It would sit there by the laundry room. I'd take out what was dirty. Yep. I would wash it and then I would put it back in. I never totally unpack.
Exactly.
Because you're going to take the same stuff with you everywhere you go.
Keep your dop kit in there. I got two pairs of running sneakers. One I keep at home. One I keep in my bag. I'd unpack all the dirty stuff, wash it, and put it back.
But put it back because, see, nobody knows that you're wearing the same stuff over and over again because you're in a different town.
Exactly. They just
saw you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Put some fresh underwear and you're ready to go.
Yeah.
So what did you take from, and by the way, the passion, you all can't see it because this is a podcast, was so in your eyes when you were talking about that mat and the smell. And I understand that because, you know, there's some days where you're like, I'm so burned out on stand-up. I don't want to go do stand-up for whatever. And then 3 days later, I'm missing it. And you go back and you're like, oh, yeah, this is the only thing I can do. It's the only thing this is where I should be.
Then you get on the road, though. For me, this is how it was. I know your son is playing baseball
now.
And you're a big part of his life.
And,
and I missed a lot of that, you know, with my girls being on the road. And I got so entrenched of being on the road and trying to get to the destination of being on the top that, man, I'd be on the road, and I might be on the road for 2 to 3 weeks. I'm like, man, I'm dead dog tired. I just want to take my ass to the house, be in my own bed. And then I get there, and it's cool. And then 2 days later, I got the itch to go back out on the road. Man, I said, man, when am I going back on the road? It's only 2.5 days.
Yeah.
Got my stuff ready. I'm out of the road.
Yeah.
And then it's just back and forth, back and forth.
It's where your passion is.
Yeah.
So now you transitioned, we'll call it your next act, and you're kicking ass in Hollywood, and you got Grown Ups coming out. You've got season three of hosting Redneck Island this month, premiering on CMT. So what did you take from wrestling that's helped you move along so well and effectively and quickly in Hollywood, which can be a very complicated town to work in? Again, it's sort of smoke and mirrors. It seems like, oh yeah, it's easy. You want to be an actor? Boom, you get a TV show. It's politics, it's this, it's that. It's no different than any other business. It's no better, no worse. What are the couple of things that happened to you as a wrestler or that you learned from the business side of wrestling or whatever it might be that's allowed you to sort of be successful in this part of your career?
Man, you gotta have skin like an alligator. You better have thick skin.
Because of the rejection.
You're going to get rejected. It's a tough racket, and you're going to get hoodwinked a lot when you first come out here and you're green. And you go to a couple of meetings, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, man, I can't believe we haven't done anything together yet. We got to do something together. Here's 2 or 3 scripts. Read these, and we'll keep talking. Hell. That's that box of 2 or 3 scripts that everybody's got in every meeting. All of a sudden, you walk through that shit. I just got me a part in a couple of movies. Bullshit.
Yeah.
You didn't get nothing.
Yeah.
They met with you. Things didn't turn out. But you got to have thick skin. You're going to get hoodwinked a few times. It don't take you long to come out in this town. And the thing about this business is, really, it's a parallel to any business. But the stakes are so much higher, and it's very deep-rooted, cutthroat by nature. So it's in many ways it's a parallel of what the pro wrestling game is. It's just a little bit bigger game out here because, you know, of the movie and the TV industry is so big.
Parallel in what way?
Well, just, you know, it's the same old stuff. It's entertainment business.
Right.
You got something that's good, we'll use it. You shit the bed, or you know you go off the rails, or you run out,
see,
or
ya.
Your looks change too much.
Yeah.
See you later.
Yeah.
You're not making money for us anymore.
Phone calls don't get returned.
Yeah.
Yep.
So and that's the same way as in life.
Yeah.
As in Dusty Rhodes when he cut the famous Hard Times promo, is working 30 times for a 30 years for a company, then all of a sudden, you know, you show up at work and they tell you a computer's taking your place and send you down the road.
Right.
You know, so it's just everything's a parallel, but once you get into the wrestling business and here in the entertainment world of television and movies, where youth and looks is your, you know, those are the cards you need to bring out here, and talent, obviously. Yeah. Now, there's some good-looking people out here without any talent that are making some change, but by and large, exactly. You know, there's I just think, you know, a lot of people just came out here and had a silver spoon in their mouth. There's so many people out here with stories of, you know, have so paid their dues and sacrificed everything to get to the top, and the same with the world of stand-up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, all of a sudden you ain't funny no more.
Yeah.
Nobody wants your ass on the show.
So you feel really prepared from wrestling to be able to tackle this, I would imagine, because of the...
I feel prepared. I feel prepared. And you know what? Coming out here to this town will teach you. Man, I got a nose like a bloodhound.
For bullshit.
I can smell bullshit a mile away. And you know what? One other thing, I don't believe anything until I see it.
Yeah.
Things sound good. They could be good, but they're not going to be good until, you know, we've got that ink on the contract that's dried and it actually happens. Yeah. That's when things are okay.
Well, even when they'll shoot stuff and then it never airs. It airs and then they cancel it after 2 hours. There's no security. And I imagine that's nose for bullshit came from the world of wrestling, right? Because you had to deal with some shady people, I would imagine.
You do, and when you first come up in a wrestling business, I mean, everybody's negotiating their own contracts. Everybody's too scared to hire a lawyer because they don't want to pay that guy a percentage of the money. And then all of a sudden, they think the office is going to be mad at them. That was the power play that the office used to play. Oh, you're using a lawyer. Well, yeah, you're using your lawyer to draw this thing up.
Yeah.
That's not fair for me to have any representation either. And that was not just for me, but for everybody.
Yeah.
If you brought a lawyer to the meeting, you were the bad guy. But these days, as I come out here, and having spent 15 years of my life on the road hardcore and been smart enough to save my money, cheap enough to save my money, because, you know, you have to, man. You got to save up for a rainy day. A lot of guys, a lot of these big-time NFL, NBA players, they start spending on the gross. They don't think about the net. They just think his money's going to keep rolling in forever. It does not.
Yeah.
You might as well set aside 40% for Uncle Sam and then make your budget off the other 60%. I mean, and really just spend about 10-15% of your money.
Yeah.
Don't spend all your money.
Yeah.
But my point is, I've been around the horn a few times. I got a lot more years left in me. I want to keep on going. I want to keep on working. I think that's the American way.
Yeah.
We're supposed to work hard.
Oh, yeah.
And if I was out here trying to get into acting when I was 20, 21, 22 years old, man, I'd be busting my ass going to auditions, doing this, doing that, taking acting classes or jumping through hoops, paying my dues, doing what I had to do because that's what you do.
Mm.
Hey, I'm not that guy.
Yeah.
I'm 48. You got something that you want to do with me, let's talk about it and then let's go do it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you don't waste my time, I won't waste yours. You know, I'm not going to jump through a bunch of hoops.
Well, you're doing some interesting stuff. I mean, you were obviously in Expendables, but you're in Grown Ups. What are you doing in what's your part in Grown Ups?
Man, I got all my scenes with Adam Sandler, and I don't want to drop too many dimes on the movie, but this is probably going to be one of the funniest movies Adam's ever done. And that's probably one of the nicest guys I've ever met since I've been in Los Angeles.
Yep.
And ever since the before the Longest Yard days, when I met him at one of our wrestling shows in New York, the guy's a longtime fan of the business.
You were a badass in that Longest Yard movie.
Oh, I was drunk. Me and Kevin Nash were so much alcohol. Well, we were out there in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We thought we was going to burst into flames. But I got a funny part in that movie. And that's one of the things that I liked about that movie was I got a chance to be funny.
Yeah.
When you spend 10 years of your life as Stone Cold Steve Austin, people think I'm drunk all the time, I'm pissed off, I'm mad, I do not laugh. And boy, that's me and my competitive element.
Yeah. But hey,
man, there's a lot more to me than that. And that's one of the things that I love to be able to get out of my podcast. That's the thing that I love to get off and get out in Redneck Island. I love the reality television world.
Yeah.
I love that space.
How is that for you? Like, host, do you like?
Love it, man.
Adjustments did you have to make to be able to do that effectively? What are you learning? Are you learning on your feet? Is there anything?
Learning on my feet.
And what are you learning?
When I was in a ring, in a squared circle, a lot of guys going to play the hard camera. You might have 6-7 cameras, but there's that one hard camera.
Sure.
A lot of guys will play to that. Me, never. Man, I'm focused in on my match. I'm not going to position myself so you can get a glory shot of me here. I mean, you got all these guys with handhelds, they'll get that shot, and it's going to be dirty, and it's going to be real. So, you know, I don't even worry about cameras. Every now and then I say, hey, your host camera's over here. I don't care. You know, you're going to film me or you're not going to film me. And every now and then I have a little copy I've got to memorize, but by and large, most of it's for me. Hmm. And, you know, when I did Tough Enough, which never got picked up, I mean, that was a total unscripted deal, which I loved. I turned down so many reality television projects when I came out here because I thought a lot of them were just dog shit projects, and I didn't want to be a part of that.
Yeah.
And so the things that I've done, I've really liked, and we're about to do another pilot for CMT called Steve Austin's Broken Skull Ranch Challenge. If you think you're tough, come out to this damn course, and we'll see if you're tough. Man, it's going to be men versus men, women versus women. Okay. But I love the timing element of that, too, because I don't know how you are, but I got a short attention span.
Yeah, me too.
You give me 30 days on location and let me haul ass, fresh as a daisy.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you're on set for movies, there's a lot of sitting around and waiting and how you're...
That's the hardest thing.
As you're not,
well, in the movies that I do, in the space that I do independent movies, otherwise known as low-budget movies. You could even call them straight-to-DVD movies.
That's all right. Hey, you're doing movies, man.
Oh, well, that's the thing. Well, see, no, but I'm glad you said that because a lot of people say, why do you just do straight-to-DVD movies? Well, I do those movies on my name, and I ain't got to go down to no studio and audition 25 times for a part. I appreciate the fact that the people that do that, that's what they do.
Hmm.
I ain't got time
for it. Plus, you're also just getting better as an actor.
Yeah, but that's not me.
Yeah.
And if these movies continue to grow and the budgets get bigger, that's a whole other thing.
You've been in some big budget movies.
Smaller parts in big movies.
Yeah, but my
deal is, hey, man, I want to stay busy enough during the year so that I can take my 2 months off during deer season, go down to the Broken Skull Ranch, and hunt
my ass. Yeah, you hunt deer, right? My buddies hunt. You got organic deer, I heard. Is that right?
Just regular. They're just South Texas deer. Oh, okay. We don't do any scientific deer. We feed them protein year-round. We're trying to grow bighorns. We let them grow old. We're not breeding them. We don't bring any different strains in. Okay. These are native South Texas deer.
You a bow hunter?
I'm going to start bow hunting. Yeah. I've bow hunted. I mean, I have a bow for years, and I'll shoot targets. Mm. But I haven't been shooting enough to want to draw back and make an unresponsible or irresponsible shot on an animal.
Yeah.
I'm all about, you know, so many anti-hunters out there. I'm proudly a hunter. I eat what I kill.
Yeah.
And it's who and what I am.
Yeah.
If, you know, I always get these people every now and then will tweet, oh, I can't believe you would kill a deer. Well, my wife's a vegetarian, and she comes from a big hunting family. She loves to go to the deer stand and just video the deer. You know, it's not about the kill,
and it's not
about that for me either.
Yeah.
Someone wants to run me down for some of my lifestyle choices.
Oh, like, whatever.
Hey, man, I mean, you know, they got cows in a slaughterhouse that's going to end up on a patty in a McDonald's hamburger, you know?
Right.
Which would you rather be, a deer in the wild enjoying life and then, bam, an instant death, or being herded through a bunch of horse shit
who's never seen
your demise. I mean, it is what it is.
It sounds like a great ranch. We have, just before I wrap up, you and I have something in common. I heard you like watches, watch aficionado.
Oh, dude, yeah.
Yeah, see, this is a watch I got. I bought myself this watch a few years ago. Before I got into stand-up, it's called a Chopard watch, and it's a chronograph off of this isn't a vintage watch, but it's modeled off of a racing watch that they had in Italy around a big race that they would run in Italy. So you've got some watches that you...
Well, yeah, I was sitting there checking out your watch. I said, man, it looks like a Chopard because I was checking out that C, and I was thinking, maybe it's not a Chopard. My eyes ain't good unless I put my glasses on, because I was thinking the other two things that I had in mind, I said it's either a Patek, which I've never seen a Patek like that, or a Langenson, and it's not that either.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I was checking out the watch. So I thought it was a Chopard. I almost got my wife the Happy Diamonds watch one time. I dig Chopard stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, this one is a IWC Aqua Timer.
Yeah, nice
white face with a white and black bezel. I just put this thing on the other day because I think I was going to a meeting, and I got a pretty good watch collection, or I'm a watch buyer. I don't know if I would say collection.
You wear them, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I beat them up.
Yeah.
But for the last 6 months, 8 months, I've been just wearing my Luminox quartz watch, a beater that I train in and do all my stuff in.
Yeah.
And so this, nice I finally put this thing back on, and I was like, man, I don't need all those watches. I said, I'm digging my Luminox. So
you know what? I living in New York, right, where you turn, there's just one high-end watch ad.
Right.
And I'll be walking down the street, and I stop, and I'm looking at the sign. My wife's like, "You don't need another watch." And I got like, because I got three or four, I don't know, whatever, sitting in the, and it's the one gift over the years. Like when I was on Wall Street working, like I went out like after my first year, second year, I had a good year, and had, and I went out and I bought myself a Gerard Perregaux watch over it. And got it in, you know, engraved. And eventually I'll give it to my son, you know, when he gets older and stuff.
Absolutely.
I bought him his first watch this year. But yeah, it's a nice little treat to give yourself. But, man, this has been phenomenal. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this. It seems like you and I have a lot in common. We have, like I said, similar experiences, performers, similar body types.
Everything.
but it seems like you took so many good things from wrestling and now you're using them in your life now, and like it just seems like it's growing and getting better, and like you figured out how to have a second act and a lot of people haven't.
Man, I tell you what, I've had a good run in a business of pro wrestling, a business that I loved, and had I not needed to get out, I would have probably wrapped it up maybe 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
But had to fold up camp a little bit sooner than I would have liked. But with that being said, I left all that behind. And for a long time, it took me a while to adjust. And, you know, maybe I went through a little bit of depression when I first came, you know, out of the business, because, you know, that was who and what I was.
Yeah.
But I moved on, and I still love the business. And I'm having so much fun doing what I'm doing now, whether it's, you know, hosting reality television. I'm so intrigued with this podcast stuff, and I love doing my Steve Austin show, and sometimes I'm scratching for material. Hmm. And
you're a great conversationalist.
I'm just talking to you, and this is you know, person to person is easy. Sometimes talking on the phone, I would love to be able to talk with more people in Los Angeles on a face to face level. And you know, how you're recording this right now is on a little Zoom H4N. I have the exact same setup laying right here, but I forgot my little microphone cover, so I'm going to start getting out and talking to a few more people face-to-face, just because it's so much easier to communicate.
Oh, yeah.
And doing this conversation.
Well, you're clearly an entertainer. Like,
you've done this interview, and you've never looked down at your notes one time, and you pulled out some pertinent information right off the top of your brain, so this whole lawyer thing, you got the IQ going.
Nah, I just did a little, I knew a fair amount about you, but I stayed in my room. I was a good boy last night and did a little bit more research and stuff and just kind of learned a little bit more. But, you know, it just goes where it goes, man. You know, that's the great thing about these conversations. This is why, you know, you and I talked about, I was a little resistant to do a podcast because there's so many podcasts out there. But it's like, it is like a place where you can do these long form interviews like they used to do on TV years ago.
Right.
Where you can really, now it's, you see somebody interesting to talk to, that somebody's got a big name or whoever, and they got 5 minutes with them, and then they got to plug their movie and they leave. And it's like, like I always get frustrated. Like I want to once interview a musician and find out, how do you write music? No one ever asks that question. Like, how do you hear those notes? How do you then write lyrics that go with those notes? Like, those conversations.
Okay, and on that note, when you come on my show, before we started rolling sound, I was asking you about writing jokes.
All right.
So that's going to be covered when you come back to L.A. if you get a chance.
Yes.
So you can be on the Steve Austin show.
I'm coming on
with
Steve Austin.
To have you.
All right, that was part two of my interview with Stone Cold Steve Austin. Just the reason I love doing this podcast is you get to talk to people like that and hear some really cool stuff about their lives, how they got to where they are, what they do, how they do what they do, and really open my eyes to what wrestling is really all about. And on November 25th and 26th, check me out at Gotham Comedy Club. I'm going to be headlining there Friday and Saturday, November 25th and 26th, Thanksgiving weekend in New York City, Gotham Comedy Club. See you next week. Thanks for checking out the podcast. And please go review it on iTunes and spread links around and tell your friends about it. It's free every week. We got great guests and more great guests coming up.